Bartosz Kwiatkowski. Just minutes before we began our broadcast today, protesters here at the UN Climate Summit interrupted a Trump administration event promoting coal and other fossil fuels.
Shame on you! Shame on you!
My name is Leona Morgan. I'm from the Navajo Nation, and we just disrupted the U.S. side event at the COP24 in Poland. And they did the same thing last year. They spoke about fossil fuels. They spoke about nuclear energy as being a solution to climate change. And this is absolutely not true.
Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you!
And that does it for today's show from Katowice, Poland. We'll be broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit throughout the week. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
KVU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KVU Evening News.
Coming up on the KVU Evening News, Sugar Shack demolition, Supreme Court in Planned Parenthood, and in international news, Black Lives Matter in Toronto.
Good evening. This is the KVU Evening News for Monday, December 10th, 2018. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Ken Jones. Tina Ferry died this past January at 53 of flu-related health complications. Her death occurred while she was an inmate at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, a women's prison located just 15 miles southwest of downtown Portland. The prison did not give Ferry a flu shot, which her daughter, Mistini Ferry, believes would have prevented her death. Today, Mistini filed a $7 million lawsuit against Oregon's Department of Corrections, citing the prison's failure to provide her mother adequate and perhaps life-saving health care. According to the Oregon Department of Corrections, only 30% of inmates in Oregon's prison system received flu shots during the 2017 and 2018 flu season. The flu shot rate at Coffee Creek was even lower. The women's prison vaccinated only 18% of the over 1,600 women held at the facility during the same season. The Oregon Department of Corrections issued a statement defending the prison's failure to vaccinate inmates, arguing that though shots are offered, there's no written policy mandating anyone to take them. During the same flu season, Coffee Creek failed to alert women in writing that flu shots were offered, a violation of its own policy. Discussing her mother's death, Mistini said, "They should have done something way before the time my mother was taken to the hospital." In the suit, Mistini also claims Coffee Creek prison employees failed to bring her mother into hospital care for 3 days, even as they documented her flu symptoms. Tina Ferry died just 2 weeks later of organ failure.
Oregon's Attorney General has approved language for a ballot measure to make psychedelic mushrooms legal. Oregon Public Broadcasting reports that the measure would reduce criminal penalties for the manufacture, delivery, and possession of psilocybin, the hallucinogen contained in psychedelic mushrooms. The Oregon Psilocybin Society plans this month to start gathering the 140,000 signatures necessary to get the measure onto the ballot in 2020. The number of signatures required is nearly equal to the population of Salem. The federal government controlled use of mushrooms in the 1970s. A spokesperson for Oregon's top prosecutor, Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, told OPB that the agency doesn't typically comment on ballot measures. A similar effort to legalize psilocybin in California recently failed.
On Wednesday, the Portland City Council passed a new plastic ordinance limiting the use of single-use plastics in the city. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler said, quote, "Besides overwhelming our landfills, plastic straws and other single-use disposables affect the health of humans and animal communities. Over 660 species, including sea turtles, whales, dolphins, and seabirds, are impacted, and in many cases die from ingesting or becoming entangled in the plastic debris. Under the new ordinance, customers will now be asked if they need single-use plastics, such as straws, utensils, before they're provided."
Today, on a little triangle of asphalt flanked by Cully Boulevard, Killingsworth, and Lombard Street, residents of the Cully neighborhood, local politicians, and state politicians gathered to celebrate the demolition of the Sugar Shack, which is now slated to become a new low-income housing lot and a new community space. Here's more. That was the sound of the Cully neighborhood women taking the first sledgehammers to a building formerly known as the Sugar Shack. The building, located at the terminus of Killingsworth Street, was a den of criminal activity in the past, in the heart of a community filled with low-income families. When the building came up for sale a few years ago, Living Cully and several of their nonprofits bought it and turned it into a community space. It is now being torn down and turned into low-income housing. State Representative Alyssa Kenny Geyer and Mayor Ted Wheeler were amongst some of the speakers present today. One of the speakers was a resident named Annette Pronk, who spoke about the heart and soul of the community at the center of this neighborhood revitalization. Here's more.
I had the privilege to have been had a leading role in the early stages of the Sugar Shack deconstruction and re-envisioning period. I got a first-hand look at the narrow, dark passageways, the way the maze of small box rooms, some with locks on the outsides of the door. I felt the shuddering of women's dreams held down in the deep pile of the red shag carpet. I imagined patterns of disillusion set in the black and white tiled walls. Partnerships brought in new energy. One that stands out in my mind is the Oregon Trades Women Pre-Apprentice Program. They were to come in.
Awesome group.
They were to come in and open up the building interior, take down the walls, break down barriers. These women were there to learn new skills, build character, and work collaboratively, to open their eyes, to open our eyes, and to re-envisioning this place. I asked these women not to be shaken by the vibe of the Sugar Shack, but rather to shake up this space. Bring in your strength, your willpower, your dreams. Be resilient. We were here to transform what had taken place here. We were here to redefine this space. We were here to bring it back to the strengthening of our community. The community has made the Living Cully Plaza, formerly known as the Sugar Shack, now a destination place for families, youth, and children. We use this space to convene, to organize, to build political power. We practice resiliency in many ways. We assist families displaced by the scrapyard fire. We initiate culturally informed trainings in emergency preparedness. We partner with our neighbors to install smoke detectors. We build our disaster resilience. The Cully Housing Action Team, CHAT, has deepened our connection with one another. We share our stories around housing and discover where we have energy and vision to act together and to root our work in relationship. We organize house meetings, we share stories and pressures, we get to know our neighbors, and we build power. We testify at City Hall, we show our collective power at rallies in support of just housing policies. We knock on doors and table at community events to ask people to support housing initiatives and to invite participation in CHAT. We develop as community leaders through trainings and workshops and through the chat leadership team. We organize home repair days where we help one another as neighbors. We upcycle sugar shack lumber and raw materials from this building and therefore reduce our landfill waste. We build relationships and we work with allies like churches and neighborhood organizations. And mostly, we have fun. We've had successful campaigns. We saved the oak leaf. Yeah. We helped pass these affordable housing bonds. Yeah. Most recently, the mobile park zone ordinance change. Yeah. And now we in chat, we rally behind Hacienda. Thank you. So in closing, here, we've learned the wisdom of the community exceeds the knowledge of experts. Now that the Sugar Shack is going down, we are at a pivot point. We stand here in the heart of our community. We want to continue to have a place to convene, to organize, to build political power. We are here for safe, stable, affordable housing. It is a right. We are resilient. We are Cully. We are proud to be poised to sledge the shack. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now we want to hear from Tony DeFalco.
Hi, my name is Tony DeFalco. I work for Verde, and this is a very special day here that, and it shows. Look at all the folks that are here. You know, when we bought this property, Hacienda, Habitat, and Verde came together and bought this place back in 2015, 1,000 people came out on this very spot to celebrate us making that purchase of this property and shutting down the criminal activities that were taking place here for 17 years in this neighborhood. 17 years, people across the street were saying, hey, do something about this place in our community. Stop the activity, illegal activity, stop the drug activity, stop the prostitution and money laundering. And it didn't happen until that day in 2014 when this place went up for sale. And we didn't have a plan. The community, we just said, we know we got to get rid of it. So let's buy it and hold it until this day today.
That was Annette Pronk, a community activist, and Tony DeFalco, the CEO of Hacienda, speaking at an event celebrating the demolition of the Sugar Shack.
Cheryl Norris of Portland native will be participating in the Great American Baking Show. Cheryl's a local black woman who works as a reliability engineer for Portland General Electric and has a passion for baking. You can tune in this week on ABC to follow Cheryl's progress on the show.
Projects and green streets designed to control stormwater. OPB reported that the Bureau of Environmental Services is spending millions on projects aimed at improving water quality, restoring wildlife habitat, and preventing flooding. But auditors with the City of Portland found the Bureau can't prove those projects are meeting their goals. This year, the Bureau invested $13 million, according to OPB, in restoration projects and green streets. Auditors say the agency needs a better system for measuring the benefits of those investments. According to the audit, the Bureau cannot report on overall progress because there is no inventory of restoration projects on which to base reporting. None of the projects we reviewed had quantifiable goals, and there are no protocols for consistent monitoring or data collection. However, there's plenty of evidence that the restoration projects have been successful. The Bureau of Environmental Services plans to collect more data at the beginning of the project to help measure benefits over time. The city's green streets use plants alongside roads to absorb stormwater and prevent sewer backups and overflows. But auditors found the Bureau doesn't have a way of determining where they're most needed or how well they're working. In addition, the Bureau is failing to inspect and maintain them.
And now it's time for today's dose of labor history in two from your host, Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, The year was 1915. That was the day the 1,000,000th Model T rolled off the Ford assembly line in Highland Park, Michigan, near Detroit. Henry Ford started Model T production 7 years earlier. For nearly 20 years, the Tin Lizzie served as the first affordable vehicle, opening up travel and leisure to a new middle class. Ford refashioned the packing house conveyor to develop the assembly line. Before production moved to the sprawling modern River Rouge complex, the Highland Park plant was considered the factory that changed the world. Ford's ambition to produce cars for the multitudes extended to his workers. As part of his campaign to beat back organizing drives by the industrial workers of the world, Ford instituted the $5 day at the Highland Park plant. For auto workers, buying a Model T, even with the $5 day, was not so easy. The $5 day actually amounted to $2.34 in wages and an additional $2.66 a day in profit sharing if Ford determined the worker was actually living right. Investigators from his sociological department visited workers in their homes. The routine intrusions into the personal lives of workers away from the job included determining spending and cleanliness habits, whether they drank or smoked, whether they were married or single, the state of the workers' marital relations, and family values. Workers who failed these home inspections were given 6 months to shape up or be fired. Ford ruled young single men, women, and blacks completely ineligible from the wage program. For a time, employee turnover plummeted and production increased. But wartime inflation and deteriorating working conditions all but killed the $5 day, which ended in 1921.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather in Portland and east of the Cascades and Hood River will be rainy with a low in the 40s, followed by more rain tomorrow and a high of around 50 degrees. Today in history, in the year 1768, the first edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica was published. The original printed first edition came up to 3 volumes in total. The last printed editions, released in 2010, totaled 35 volumes altogether. Although the Encyclopedia does not publish in print edition anymore, it is still running strong on the internet. The quote of the day is from Thomas Brackett Reed, a former Speaker of the House of Representatives, speaking about his colleagues in around the year 1895. They never open their mouths without subtracting from the sum of human knowledge.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, the Potawatomi community in northeast Wisconsin is starting a campaign to fight opioid addiction. Minneapolis is trying to find shelter for their houseless population in these very cold months. And Rapid City, South Dakota is home to a new enterprise called Indian Collective, aimed at economic autonomy within the community.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Forest County Potawatomi community has started a campaign to fight opioid abuse in northeastern Wisconsin. Ken Krall has more.
The public awareness campaign will begin with television ads and print displays in local media. It also includes a website with specific details on where people can find addiction treatment and inpatient or outpatient counseling services. The Health Division Administrator for the Potawatomi community, Julie Beeney, says the impact of opioids locally is significant.
Forest County is home to 700 of our tribal members. We have a total tribal enrollment of just over 1,600, and over 700 of them live here in Forest County. And of those, the tribe estimates that somewhere between 20 to 25% have struggled with some form of addiction.
The tribe has a large casino in Milwaukee, about 200 miles south of the reservation. While the campaign moves to have people with addictions seek help, Beeney says the goal is also to have a stepped-up law enforcement presence to keep the drugs out. With the help of a state grant, the tribe has set up new programs and hired additional specialists to help people struggling with addiction. Data from the Forest County Sheriff's Department shows the county has seen 37 non-fatal opioid-related overdoses and 9 deaths related to opioids so far in 2018. In northern Wisconsin, Ken Kroll reporting.
A transition is expected to take place this week in Minneapolis, Minnesota, for people at a large homeless encampment to a navigation center. Tribal leaders, city officials, and members of the Native community met Sunday to discuss moving people to large heated tents. The Minneapolis Star Tribune reports the packed public meeting became heated at times as an outreach group assisting people has been accused of harassment. Leaders are calling for unity between all groups trying to help people living there. Hundreds of people, mostly Native Americans, including families, children, and pregnant women, have lived there for months. Efforts to clear the camp and find housing has been in the works. There are concerns about winter weather and safety. Rapid City, South Dakota, is home to a new Native enterprise called Indian Collective. The organization was created by the innovator of Thunder Valley, a new community on the Pine Ridge Reservation. The group is focusing on self-directed economic development in Indian country. Victoria Wicks reports.
Vice President Kim Pate says Indian Collective plans to offer grants, loans, and advocacy to tribes trying to improve their economy in ways grounded in sovereignty, tradition, and culture. She says not all communities are alike, and so the collective will defer to tribes to determine what their needs are. One overriding interest, however, is climate change and energy. Pate says renewable energy can create industry and jobs on reservations where sunshine and wind are abundant resources. Pate says a healthy economy supports a healthy community.
When you move families out of poverty, you do see improvement on all of the indicators where we're currently lagging, whether it's suicide rates or alcoholism or dropout rates from high school or infant mortality. Because families with stronger balance sheets are able to thrive in all those other areas.
Pay says Indian Collective is looking at funding large projects such as housing developments and businesses. Indian Collective also plans to assist with grassroots organizing and lobbying to promote policies and laws that support tribal economic development. Pate says that effort can include protesting pipelines or asking for national or state requirements that financial education be taught in the schools. Indian Collective officially started October 1st, and lending is scheduled to begin in 2019. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
And I'm Ann.
CurrentCast is a daily program dedicated to all issues facing our freshwater. On today's episode, how to avoid stormwater pollution prevention in these cold winter months.
Preventing stormwater pollution in winter on this CurrentCast. Salt, sand, chemical concoctions, and even fertilizers are used to melt ice and provide traction in wintry climates. But when the snow and ice melt, those same items which provide a safe environment wash into storm drains and local water supplies. The side effects of these common winter products include reducing oxygen levels in water, burning and killing vegetation, or increasing sediment buildup in the water, all of which can degrade aquatic habitats. So, to stay safe and reduce the amount of pollution going into the water this winter, try these tips. Shovel frequently during storms, use only one entrance to your home, and use just as much product as necessary, and no more. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
The U.S. Supreme Court refused today to hear a case regarding states' efforts to exclude Planned Parenthood and other health care providers that offer abortion counseling from Medicaid programs. The Supreme Court's decision leaves in place the ruling of two lower courts that found states violate federal law when they terminate Medicaid contracts with Planned Parenthood affiliates who offer preventive care for low-income women. The cases were part of anti-choice initiatives by Louisiana and Kansas, which would defund Planned Parenthood and make it harder for citizens to get quality reproductive health care. It would have taken four justices to agree to hear the case, but only three voted yes: Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch. Chief Justice John Roberts and the newest justice, an alleged sexual abuser, Brett Kavanaugh, sided with the court's other justices in not taking up the case, perhaps in an effort to avoid high-profile abortion-related issues, for now at least. The case concerned whether states, in this case Louisiana and Kansas, could block Medicaid funds from offices that provide women with annual health screening, contraceptive coverage, and cancer screening. If states do terminate Medicaid provider agreements, beneficiaries can challenge the termination in federal court.
The Middle East Minute Plus is a daily roundup of significant issues from the Middle East and is brought to us by Jewish Voice for Peace and KPFK. On today's episode, a leaked document shows that a group called Creative Community for Peace, or CCFP, is deliberately hiding that it is a front group for the Israeli government, whilst courting celebrities to represent them. Here's more.
I'm Esti Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. In a leaked confidential report, a front group for Israel lobby organization Stand With Us admits, quote, "The cultural boycott movement is constantly growing and changing, developing new and innovative tactics to reach artists," end quote. Creative Community for Peace, or CCFP, carefully hides from the artists it approaches that it is in fact a front group for the Israel lobby organization Stand With Us, which has close ties to the Israeli government, instead claiming to advocate for building bridges while echoing racist and dehumanizing anti-Palestinian propaganda from the Israeli government. In a leaked confidential report, CCFP made a series of frank admissions about the inspiring growth of the BDS human rights movement, as covered by The Hollywood Reporter when Los Angeles-based singer Lana Del Rey canceled her scheduled appearance in Tel Aviv earlier this year, noting that she wouldn't have been able to perform in both Israel and Palestine and treat all of her fans equally. Parts of the confidential report exposing CCFP's fraudulent attempts to manipulate artists and the public are posted on the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel website at bdsmovement.net. Tax and registration documents prove that Stand With Us and CCFP are a single nonprofit organization. In other news, the family of Suha Jibara, a U.S. citizen and former New Jersey resident who was arrested by Palestinian security forces over a month ago, has called for U.S. officials to intercede on her behalf. According to her family, Jibara's health is deteriorating, having suffered torture and gone on hunger strike. Amnesty International has also launched a campaign on her behalf. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
Black residents in Canada's largest city are 20 times more likely to be shot dead by the police than white residents, according to a landmark report from the province's human rights watchdog. The Ontario Human Rights Commission studied 7 years of data surrounding interactions between police and black residents in Toronto for the report, which found that black residents face disproportionate discrimination and violence at the hands of the police. While black residents make up less than 10% of the city's population, they accounted for 61% of all cases where police used force that resulted in death and 70% of police shootings that resulted in death. When it comes to law enforcement, when it comes to the police, there's an overarching reality of violence that's often a part of the fabric of everyday life for black people in this country, according to Robin Maynard, author of Policing Black Lives. Quote, "I think this data is absolutely damning and reveals something very important." The report also found that the practice of carding, where police stop residents and collect personal information, revealed a lack of legal basis and often included inappropriate or unjustified searches during encounters and unnecessary charges or arrests. For many in the city, however, the data merely confirmed a reality they had long known existed. Cities need to rethink the notion of public safety, said Maynard, focusing more on safe and affordable housing, instead of increasing police presence in low-income neighborhoods, which greatly increases the chances of violent interactions with police.
Climate Connections is dedicated to climate change news and what we can do about it. On today's episode, how tribal farming knowledge is being utilized in the face of climate change.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Andrea Carmen is a member of the Yaqui Indian Nation of Arizona and Mexico. 40 years ago, she visited her tribal chief.
He showed me a whole room full of these little black ears of corn, and he said, "This is Yaqui corn. This is our seeds. The corn knows how to grow with hardly any water, and the time's going to come when we need this corn back again. So I'm keeping it for us." And he gave me an ear.
Carmen says indigenous people around the world have saved seeds and preserved knowledge of traditional farming practices.
We had seeds for dry weather and wet weather and cold and hot, and our elders and our ancestors knew what kind of seeds to plant.
She says this knowledge can help tribes adapt to more frequent droughts and extreme weather. Carmen now directs the International Indian Treaty Council. Her group organizes community trainings and international conferences so people can share their seeds and methods.
We're bringing indigenous peoples together, even from different continents that have similar food systems, to talk about what has been passed down, what are some practices that are being successful. This is a way of resiliency that comes from our own people, from our own traditions.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The Public News Service is a daily roundup of national issues that might not be covered in mainstream media. Here's today's episode.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, December the 10th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Nick Ayer is set to reject Trump's offer to be the White House chief of staff. Also on the Monday rundown, help still needed in areas hit hard by Hurricane Michael. And look for a domestic workers' bill of rights to be introduced in the Congress next year. Topping our news, Nick Ayers, President Donald Trump's top choice to replace John Kelly as chief of staff, has declined to take the job. That from the New York Times, according to three people familiar with the talks. The Times adds that leaves it unclear who will take the top White House job as Trump enters the 2020 campaign in growing danger from the special counsel and also from Democrats who have vowed tougher oversight as they take control of the House next month. Today is the deadline for many displaced Panama City residents living in tents behind the Forest Park Methodist Church to leave by an order from the city, and one observer says that will leave them to fend for themselves.
The city didn't allow tent camping, but made exceptions for workers and others after Hurricane Michael. The church initially set the December 10th deadline, and Mayor Greg Brodnicki says they will enforce it. Flagler County resident Steve Lowe has made several trips to Panama City in his camper since the storm. On his own, he's brought supplies and used social media to alert friends to chip in. Lowe says he's seen little help from the city for the homeless.
Nobody's giving any information out from the government about where they could go. The local government is not trying to help them. They're not trying to find a place for them to move. They're not trying to transport them somewhere. They're not finding a place for them to go. They're just saying, you got
to
get out.
Lowe says he's been trying to get organizations like the ACLU to halt today's evictions. I'm Tramel Gomes.
About 80% of the buildings in Bay County were destroyed or severely damaged by the storm, and nearly 4,000 students in the county are considered homeless. Last week's proposal to return the Confederate monument, nicknamed Silent Sam, to the UNC campus has sparked a backlash, including protests and some are calling riots. More from Antoinette Kerr.
Silent Sam advocates and opponents are making their voices heard after the University of North Carolina announced a more than $5 million price tag to restore the Confederate-era statue on its campus. Maya Little, a UNC graduate student, was arrested for smearing her blood on the statue just before it was toppled in August. She was arrested again during last week's anti-Sam protest. Little is vowing to fight the return of what she believes to be a symbol of racism.
I literally put my blood and red ink on the statue because the statue and all statues like it are already drenched in black blood.
Little referenced the 1913 monument dedication, where philanthropist Jillian Carr was reported as saying, "I horsewhipped a Negro wench until her skirts hung in shreds," and called it his pleasing duty.
The Michigan House of Representatives expected to take up a proposal this week that critics say would make the state a magnet for radioactive waste from fracking around the country.
The state Senate has already passed SB 1195, which would allow specialized Type 1 landfills like the one run by U.S. Ecology in Belleville to accept radioactive waste measuring 10 times the current federal standard, even 100 times more, with extra precautions. Diane Weckerly with Michigan Citizens for Water Conservation says very few states allow this material.
You know, you would think that the politicians would learn after the Flint water crisis that they would be concerned. This legislation opens the barn doors in Michigan, calling on different states to bring in their radioactive waste.
At issue is a byproduct of fracking called technologically enhanced naturally occurring radioactive material, or TNORM. A second bill adds a disposal fee of $5 per ton to go towards safety monitoring. I'm Suzanne Potter.
That legislation would leave it up to landfill owners, not regulators, to evaluate incoming waste for potential radioactive exposure. Two federal lawmakers raising concerns now about whether new 5G technologies will cause cancer, that from Fierce Wireless. They report that Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut and Representative Anna Eshoo of California sent a letter to the FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr asking for guidance on the topic. They wrote in part, "We request that you provide our offices the 5G safety determination from FCC and relevant health agencies." The lawmakers added, "Most of our current regulations regarding radio frequency safety were adopted back in 1996 and have not been updated." And finally, Eric Tegedoff reports a National Domestic Workers Bill of Rights will be introduced in Congress next year.
Among its sponsors is Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington State. The bill would provide a wide range of protections for domestic workers, including labor protections and safeguards from workplace harassment. It also would establish fair practices for scheduling, rest breaks, and paid sick days. Jayapal says the bill addresses gender, social, and economic justice for a workforce that is largely made up of women of color and immigrants, making poverty-level wages. She believes it will attract more people to domestic work and also improve the quality of their work.
Domestic workers are looking after the people who are most precious to us in our lives. Right, our parents, our seniors, our kids. And we need to make sure that they are paid appropriately and that they have appropriate protections so that they can be more effective at doing their jobs.
By the way, 7 in 10 Washingtonians will need care before the end of their lives. And with a wave of baby boomers aging, the need for home-based care is growing rapidly, but a lack of basic on-the-job protections could make it hard to fill that need. I'm Mike Clifford, and thanks for starting your week newsin' and cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 10th, 2018. Here are the main points again. The family of a woman who died in Coffee Creek confinement filed a suit today. Oregon is looking into the legalization of mushrooms, and the building formerly known as the Sugar Shack was demolished today. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emily Gresham Beamer. Welcome to the team. Grace Ann Smith and Ken Jones. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, call-in show covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, on alternative radio, lawyer and activist Arjun Singh Sethi looks at the current politics of hate and how extremist groups are using technology to spread vitriol. At 10, you'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, Art Focus interviews Peggy Sue Amison about the show In Transit, on now at Blue Sky Gallery. Support KBOO during this holiday membership drive. You can call us at 877-500-KBOO or go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Grace Ann. Good night, Danielle. Thank you.
producer Upersent from Valencia, Spain, with the title track from his 2016 release on Berlin-based Upon You Records, Penumbra. You're listening to Deep Threes. I'm Jay. Eric Pietras shared the soundtrack for some of his unique experiences in the San Francisco Bay Area on his Beams album. Our next sonic expedition embarks from Duck Island, a tiny haven for wildlife in the middle of man-made Lake Elizabeth, all nestled within Fremont, California's Central Park.
it's so difficult to give up, tied to it by small things, my eyes noting movement, color and form. I am watching, unable to leave, for something is happening, and so I stand in a shower of rain or under a hot sun, worn out with looking. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor this Monday's Clinton Street Resistance film, Les Miserables, on Monday, December 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Les Miserables is a 2012 musical drama based on the 1862 French novel of the same name by Victor Hugo. The film takes place during early 19th century and tells the story of Jean Valjean, who, after breaking parole, agrees to care for a factory worker's daughter. The story reaches resolution against the background of the June Rebellion. The screening is a benefit for Oregon Walks. Again, that's Les Miserables on Monday, December 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6:01 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.